Time for another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome our two guests back today. Laura Gell, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in Woody Ornamentals, let's get that out, in the Department of Horticulture, and Brian Huddleston. Brian is a plant disease diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison and with UW Extension as well. So obviously, what are we going to talk about? Well, Woody Ornamentals, then we'll talk about plant diseases of all types.
Yes, indeed.
Welcome.
The only thing I don't cover is turf.
All right. Well, we can cover everything but turf, and we can certainly zero in on those woody ornamentals as well with Laura. So, Laura, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Good to see you on a beautiful day.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Well, I tell you what, if you have a question, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Either way, we'll get you on the air with your question, we hope, if we have enough time. So call now. Email now and avoid the late hour rush here as we visit with Brian and Laura. And, you know, emerald ash borer, I talked about it a little bit last week on the program, but that's certainly a major concern for a lot of people when it comes to trees. And we know that we now have it on both sides of the state, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Yes, indeed.
And what are we going to do about it?
It's a good question.
We don't know, do we? Well, we have some good ideas about things we should be doing, do we not,
mm-hmm.
Laura?
Well, monitoring your ash trees, making sure, you know, looking for those D-shaped exit holes. Unfortunately, this insect attacks perfectly healthy trees.
Yeah.
It's not like our native borers that often attacked stress trees. Emerald ash borer attacks both healthy trees as well as stress trees. And very often the trees are asymptomatic, meaning they don't show any symptoms of the insect, and yet you dig underneath the bark and there's tons of them. So it's a bad critter. It's hard to get rid of. There are products that are out there on the market that are systemics that get inside the plant that kill the larvae inside the plant. There's a website.
Yes, there is.
Yeah. Dr. Chris Williamson has a very nice fact sheet for homeowners. It's a homeowner's guide to emerald ash borer pesticides. And let me just look real quick. I'm
reaching over and taking a look at the computer here. I could have pulled that up on my screen, actually.
Actually, it's available at the Wisconsin Horticulture website, which is wihort.uwex.edu. Just click on the Garden Facts link on that main page, and that'll take you to our table of one-page fact sheets and look under insects under homeowner for the homeowner list of insecticides that are available for EAB control.
Well, I'm sure we'll probably have some more questions about emerald ash borer as we move along here today. But let's think about more positive things. You know, we're coming up. It won't be long. I was looking at my watch here to time it out. But one of my favorite times of the year is when the lilacs bloom. And you have a publication out, do you not, Laura?
Yes, I do.
On lilacs for cold climates?
Yeah, lilacs for cold climates. It's available at the Learning Store.
UWEX.edu.
Mm-hmm. And it's under trees and shrubs, under care. It's one of a number of new extension publications I have out. And I think it's about 16 to 20 page long. It talks about all the different species of lilacs, as well as all the cultivars that are commercially available. Literally, there are over thousands of cultivars of lilacs. Many of which are not commercially available because you would have to have a huge nursery to grow all of them.
Sure.
So I've listed all the ones that are commercially available, ones that are also more disease resistant. There's a number of very nice lilacs that are out there commercially, and you can get them. They're beautiful plants. They need a lot of space, so make sure you give them a lot of room. Smaller lilacs for the home landscape that I really like, one's called Miss Kim. Miss Kim lilac is a very popular one. Gets about 5 to 6 feet in height. Has beautiful flowers about the third week of May. It's a little bit later than the other lilacs. And the fall color is actually somewhat burgundy. And the other one I really like, a couple of them, they're the dwarf lilacs. One in particular is called Palabin. It's also known as dwarf Korean lilac or Palabin lilac. That one's very popular. It only gets about 4 to 5 feet and has smaller flowers, but the whole plant is just covered in them. And another one that's just like that that I like is called Tinkerbell. And Tinkerbell is just like Palibin, same size and flower, except it's pink instead of the lilac color.
Oh, I love visiting the UW Arboretum along about mid-May or so.
And Mother's Day.
Mother's Day. That's the time to be there, along with several thousand of my closest friends, and we all smell the wonderful aromas from the lilacs. Well, back to other problem areas, Brian. What, at this time of the year, before we go to the phones here, this time of the year, what do we think? What are you thinking about in terms of talking with homeowners about plant disease kinds of issues?
Definitely, probably the biggest thing in my mind is if folks haven't gotten their quote unquote fall cleanup done yet, this would be the time to make sure you're getting out there and removing any of the old plant debris from last year. So cutting back perennials that have died back, getting rid of that material, get it out of your yard, because for many of the disease-causing organisms that I deal with, they tend to spend the winter in that old plant debris. And if you leave that, those old leaves, those old stems sitting around, it can serve as a source of particularly fungi that can reinfect your new plant material as it begins to come up. Although given the weather that we've had, I'm kind of wondering whether anything is ever going to come up. Things seem very, very slow this year, but it gives us a little extra time to do that cleanup if it hasn't been done yet.
Well, lots of callers online to visit with you, too. So let's go to the phones. Barb in Tomahawk up first. Barbara, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about a very nice azalea bush on the east side of my house that's been there for more than 5 years, but I'd like to trim it back to match the fairly new rhododendron that I've planted nearby. Can you give me some advice on how to do that?
Yes. Is it a spring flowering or summer flowering azalea?
I believe it's spring.
Okay. Most of them are spring flowering. With azaleas and rhododendrons, I do not recommend pruning very much at all unless there's some dead wood. And the reason why is azaleas and rhododendrons both flower at the very tips of the branches. And by pruning them back heavily, and especially in our climate, they may not come back very well at all. They don't have adventitious buds farther back down on the stem like some other shrubs do. And if you cut them back heavily, you may just cut the plant out entirely. It grows from the tips of the branches. Now, in southern climates where I used to live, in southern climates, they regularly cut back azaleas and rhododendrons, but they also have a 8 to 9 month growing season, and
story there.
Yeah. So if I would just remove some of the dead wood, you might want to shape it a little bit, meaning you bring it just tip pruning. It would encourage bushiness, but you don't want to cut azaleas and rhododendrons back very hard at all.
Okay, there you have it, Barb. Thank you for calling, Cherie in Port Wing. We are on to you now. Hi, Cherie.
Hi, bonjour. My neighbor was given a hibiscus plant about a year and a half ago. And I'm a vegetable gardener. I really don't know anything about this hibiscus plant, but he keeps coming to me every time it blooms, every time a bloom falls off, every time the leaves fall off, and he wants to know what to do with it, and do they go dormant during the winter, and we know nothing about it.
Okay, is this a cold hardy hibiscus? Is this one that flowers every year? He leaves outside all year round?
No.
He brings it inside.
But it has been, during the winter, occasionally popping a lovely peach-colored bloom.
Indoors?
For a day, and it falls off.
Yeah,
indoors. Okay, this is a non-hardy hibiscus. There is a hardy hibiscus, for those of you out there that might be interested. It's called Rose of Sharon. And Rose of Sharon is actually a Zone 5 plant, so we're really on the borderline here in Madison. That one is cold hardy, and it flowers in summer. And each flower lasts one day, closes up, and falls to the ground, but it continuously flowers. Now, the hibiscus that you're talking about is more of a tropical hibiscus, which is typically you put on your patio in the summertime, and then in winter or in fall, before it gets below 30 degrees, you bring it inside because it won't survive the winter. How to get it to rebloom as soon, you know, I don't know. Right now, it might be a little early to put on your patio yet because if it gets below freezing, it would die.
It's done.
So wait till it gets a little bit warmer. Repot it trim it a little bit and put it on your patio. Make sure you water it and fertilize it, because hibiscus are require a lot of nutrition.
There you have it. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. There are probably some things online, too, about hibiscus.
Yeah.
I don't think – I was trying to remember if UW Extension had anything on hibiscus, but I
don't, because it's more of an indoor plant.
Yeah, it's more of an indoor plant.
One of the main things that we see in terms of – it's not actually a disease problem, but what we see – it's not truly an insect problem as well, but mites as well we tend to see problems with. So you can get some problems with insects and insect relatives indoors. You need to watch for that.
Let's go to Tim and Ripon next. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I've got a question about a wisteria that I planted probably 15 years ago, and it was in, kind of shaded by some trees, some big maple trees, and it never bloomed. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that has something to do with
it. Oh, yes. They need sun.
They need lots of sun. Well, I mean, it got afternoon sun and got morning sun, but it didn't get a lot of during the whole day, so that would do it then, huh?
Well, it depends. What do you know? What species of wisteria you have?
Not really. No.
Okay.
No, my wife got it at a nursery years ago, I'd always like to have one. And
yeah, there's different species of wisteria. If it's the Chinese wisteria or the Japanese wisteria, both of those are not cold hardy here. And they won't flower for you. The flower buds will be killed. Now, the one that I really recommend is the Kentucky wisteria. That one's native to Kentucky, obviously, in lower parts of the U.S. It's not native here, but the Kentucky wisteria, unlike the Chinese and Japanese wisteria, is not invasive. Chinese and Japanese wisteria not only aren't hardy here, they're also very invasive in the middle and southern U.S. The Kentucky wisteria is a very nice one. It flowers in about right around the first week of June, depending on where you are in the state. It also is one that is hard to get to flower if you over-fertilize it. It does not need a lot of nitrogen. If you over-fertilize it, it would produce vegetative shoots. Another thing is pruning. The wisteria, Kentucky wisteria, needs pruning. So you would prune back the side branches back to the main stem, leaving about two buds on the side branches. If it's really overgrown, you're not cutting the whole thing back. You're just bringing those side shoots that are coming off the main stem. You're cutting those back to within about 3 to 4 inches, making sure you leave several buds on those little stems. And that will also promote flowering.
Okay, well, we tried that a couple of years ago, and for the last several years, and or not necessarily the two buds, but I trimmed it back, and that didn't do any good. So I'm hoping it's just the shade, and I'm thinking it must be cold hardy because it really does well here. And
well,
so far,
flower buds and vegetative buds often have different cold hardiness. It's like forsythias, for example. Forsythias, I have one at home. It has beautiful leaves, but it never flowers. So it's actually going to be coming out of my yard. Give it to my neighbor.
Oh, there you have it. Thank you very much, Tim, for calling. Appreciate it. And Katie in Green Bay, we're on to you in just a second, but I want to just remind everybody that we are talking plant diseases, although we haven't gotten too much into plant diseases yet. We will. And Woody Ornamentals with Laura Jell, Extension Horticulturist in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. She's an associate professor there. And Brian Huddleston, who's plant diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison and with UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Christy Taylor, our on-air producer today. You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller with my guests Laura Jell and Brian Huddleston. Let's take some more calls. The number, by the way, for you to join in is 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Katie in Green Bay, you are up. Hi, Katie.
Hi. And my quick question is it the time to put down corn gluten? And if so, would it also take care of dandelions? I know it does pre-emergent work. And the second part of that would be, since it might rain this weekend, if it's now the time we put it down now, is that a good thing or a bad thing with the rain?
All right, that's a little out of our area, but Brian.
Actually, I'm not going to give you a specific answer, but I'm going to give you a telephone number of someone. I'm taking you're asking about whether to apply this to your lawn. And if
yes,
I'm going to give you the phone number of somebody that you can call. I'm going to have you call our turf diagnostic lab. And their phone number is area code 608-845-2535. And you can talk to Paul Koch, who's the diagnostician out there, and he can give you some of the lowdown on kind of the current thought on corn gluten and how well it does.
I do know that corn gluten meal is used as a pre-emergent. It does not work as a post-emergent. So if you already have dandelions up, it's not going to kill them.
Okay.
All right. Definitely,
thank you very much.
I'd give the turf folks a call. They can give you a much better answer than either one of us.
Yep. We'll stay away from the lawn questions today as much as we can. Let's go to Gordon in Wausau next. Hi, Gordon. Thank you for calling.
Yes, we have a Pachysandra patch that has been in existence for about 20-some years. But it gets scale, and the scale gradually chokes it off. We've treated the scale with oil once a year, but is there Pachysandra that is scale resistant?
No, I don't know of any. I've never seen personally scale on Pachysandra.
I have seen it occasionally, and those samples go up to Phil Pelletieri, but I have seen scale on Pachysandra.
Horticultural oils there's also dormant oils. The difference is the viscosity of the oil. Dormant oils can only be used in temperatures below, I think it's 50 degrees, and it's really getting too late to use some of those products. Horticultural oils are more refined. Those can also be used to treat scale. The scale themselves, you will still be there. The dead bodies will still be on the plant. It's with the dormant oils and the horticulture oils, it smothers the scale insect, so they will die. There's also another way of treating scale, and it has to do with the crawler stage. And the crawler stage is when the scale insect has laid its eggs, and the babies that come out, actually, they're... what's
little
the scientific
nymphs.
Nymphs. Thank
nymphs.
You. I'm trying to find the
they
word. The nymphs.
Phil calls them crawlers. So
yeah, the nymphs come out, or the crawlers come out, and then they start to feed, and then they then become the adult insects that stay there. There is a timing, a very specific timing on when you can treat for the crawler stage. Most people use the dormant oils or horticulture oils to smother the insect. If the infestation is super severe and you've got a lot of dead dieback, I would just remove it and plant something else in that location. But if the plant still looks somewhat healthy and you can do the dormant oils. I'm not sure when the timing for the crawler stage
is. That's my question, too, and it does vary from type of scale to type of scale. So what I would suggest on this would be to give your county extension office a call and ask for additional information. They can get specifics from our insect diagnostician in Madison and then get back to you about it, because it does really depend on the type of scale, and the crawlers will come out. And it's really targeting those crawler stages because they're soft-bodied, and the oils tend to be most effective on those very young insects.
Just off the top of my head, I wouldn't guess that Gordon was saying that they apply this oil once a year. Well, once is not...
Once will probably not do it, and if you applied it at the wrong time, it wouldn't do anything at all. So it's definitely, you need to find out when those crawlers are most active and get an application or one or more applications on during that period when they're active.
All right. Thanks, Gordon. Thank you for calling. Joan in Green Bay, we are on to you now. Hi, Joan.
Good morning.
Morning. What can we do for you?
I wanted to know about spider mites in evergreen trees. You had them sprayed, and I think it got rid of the spider mites, but the inside of the tree is all brown.
Yeah,
I just wondered if that would ever come back or if the tree should be cut down.
No, the tree come back. The needles aren't going to come back, and some of that browning could be from the feeding from the mites, because they do enough damage sometimes, that particularly over the wintertime when trees are a little bit stressed for water, those interior needles will dehydrate and then they'll turn brown and fall off. There is also a disease, though, that's very common on spruce trees that will cause that same sort of interior needle browning. It's called rhizosphera needle cast. That's the most common disease that we see. There's also another disease called stigmina needle cast. These are both fungal diseases. And these fungi will infect the needles. The symptoms tend to pop up on those interior needles where you get a nice moist environment in the interior of the tree canopy. And those needles will fall off, and don't expect them to come back. Typically what you see with this mite injury or these fungal diseases that I'm talking about is kind of a bare branch with little tufts of green needles on the end. And it doesn't look very, very aesthetically pleasing, but your tree is in imminent danger of dying. What you can do to make the tree look a little bit better, if those bare bottom branches really bother you, is simply prune them. And you get what Laura, I know Laura doesn't like lollipop trees, as she calls them, but sometimes with Rhizosphera, with some of these other problems where the interior needles are lost, it's a better looking tree if you do trim those off rather than leaving them.
Yeah. There you have
it. Right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
And we do have a fact sheet on Rhizosphera needle casts at our website. So wihort.uwex.edu, and then click on the Garden Facts link and look for Rhizosphera, that's R-H-I-Z-O, in the disease column. And you'll find a fact sheet on that particular disease. And there's also a fact sheet on spruce spider mites as well that gives additional information.
What was that website again?
wihort.uwex.edu.
Okay.
We've got about 180 titles in our fact sheet series. We've been adding a lot this spring, so there's a lot of new ones out.
wihort.uwex.edu.
That's right.
All right. Thanks, Joan. Let's go to another Joan in Milwaukee this time. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. I am looking out over my backyard. It's just loaded with scilla all the way around. My neighbor has his yard absolutely beautiful, but nothing on it. He has it treated. Is there anything that I can do to keep my scilla and to keep my wildflowers that come up pretty wildly as the year goes on, but destroy what he says is creeping Charlie or something?
Creeping Charlie, yeah. It's a little vine. What I would suggest with the scilla, if you want to keep that, this particular plant is near and dear to my heart.
I love
because
it too.
The first research project I ever did back in high school was on that particular plant, so I have fond memories of it. What my suggestion would be is that particular plant will die back naturally as we get into the summer. It is a bulb, and if you did late season applications of some of the broad Spectra are broadleaf herbicides on your lawn, and these are oftentimes found in the weed and feed sort of lawn products that are out there, I think you would get relatively good control of that. What you really want to do is avoid the early summer or late spring application, because your scilla is still going to be leafing out, and if those chemicals come into contact with the scilla leaves, you're going to kill off your scilla as well.
Are you trying to get rid of the creeping Charlie?
Well, I don't. My real question was, I was just sitting here admiring my blue scilla, as I often do. My question is, we have a row of arborvitae around the perimeter of the stockade fence, and a friend gave me some blackberry plants, and they were beautiful. I foolishly put them in the corner where there was an arborvitae coming up. Well, this was 2 years ago, and last year I just finished the last pint of fresh frozen blackberries. But these plants are going up over the arborvitae. They've stunted it, and over the stockade fence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what do I do with this? Do I cut this back now, or do I... I tried to move one of them last fall, but I'm looking at it on the other side of the yard, and it doesn't look like it's going to live. What do I do? Get rid of the arborvitae, or...
Well, it depends what you want more.
Yeah.
Do you want the blackberries, or do you want the arborvitae? Because blackberries...
I want blackberries.
Yeah, the blackberry is a very vigorous plant. It's going to grow rampantly. They're very vigorous. It'll grow over many other plants. So if you want the blackberry, I would say... then you sacrifice the arborvitae. You can prune them back, but they do flower in spring. So if you do prune them back heavily now, you are removing the flowers, which leads to the fruit. So do realize you're going to have reduced fruit production this year.
So another one where you'd wait until after they fruit and then
you
do the
could,
pruning.
Even though that's one of the worst times of year to prune is summertime because of the disease issues. But blackberry needs a lot of room to grow.
Yeah.
Can I move them?
You could move that. Where are you in the state?
In Milwaukee.
Milwaukee, okay. Yeah, we're getting close. It's getting kind of iffy to move them this time of year because they are going to start to leaf out. As soon as you start seeing the plant leaf out, you don't move them. That's the worst time of year to move plants because they're starting to produce new leaves. If it's still fully dormant, yes, you could move it now. The only thing is you got to make sure you water it and monitor it because it's going to be drying out a lot faster.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Joan, for calling. Appreciate it. Alex in Belleville will go on to you now. Hi, Alex.
Hi, and thanks for your show. It's the best show on the radio.
Thank you.
I've got a question about ash trees. I've got probably a 20-acre hillside that has got quite a few different ash trees in it, probably several hundred, and most of them are dead. And I've been watching to see if I can see this famous emerald ash borer creature come out from underneath the bark as I pull it off, and I never find any. I'll find a black bug that's kind of long and sort of cockroach-looking, sort of like the American cockroach, but it's just pure black front to back, and there's not even a hint of green, even in sunshine, that I can detect.
Okay.
And it seems to have wiped out a lot of trees. I mean, not the bug, but this whatever's killing them is killing an awful lot of trees.
There are other issues.
There are other issues. One question I have. First of all, where are you in the state?
Belleville.
Belleville, south of here.
Yeah, 15 miles south of Madison.
Okay. How long have you noticed these trees dying?
About a year is what I think. You know, I had a couple die, and I didn't think much of it because trees die, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I did look at the bark and tried to, you know, of the trees I found. But now there's a lot of them.
Okay. What's that phone number? That's the Emerald Ash Borer Hotline. I'm trying to remember the phone number.
I'll come up with it.
Okay. There's a 1-800 number for Emerald Ash Borer if you suspect Emerald Ash Borer. It could be a native borer, but if you're seeing that many trees dying, were these trees stressed or were they perfectly healthy looking?
You know, I have no idea. It's in the woods, and it's in a very, very thick woods. The woods was grazed probably 40 years ago, and the amount of honeysuckle that's in there makes it almost impenetrable.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't tell you. I thought maybe a couple of the first trees might have been stressed because of a farm road that goes through that particular woods.
Yeah.
You know, I thought maybe just running over its roots or whatnot, you know, compacted things too much, and that's why it died. But, the other ones didn't have anything unusual.
Did that area flood this past year?
There's no chance of flooding at the north side hillside about 100 feet up above bottom land.
Hmm.
I think this would be a situation where we'll get you that 800 number or toll-free number and give them a call and express your concerns, and they can give you a further evaluation and then possibly send out some folks to take a look at that particular area. One of the things, you may not actually see the insects. They're relatively small, and it sometimes is hard to actually see the adults. What you do want to look for underneath the bark would be kind of serpentine trails where the larvae feed.
Okay.
If you see anything of that sort, that would definitely be another red flag that you've got a potential problem. But this is sounding a little bit suspicious. It's hard to tell because there are a lot of other things that can kill off ash trees. But because of the concern about emerald ash borer, I think this is something that you'll probably want to follow up.
And the insects are really close underneath the bark. They're very small.
Right. Very, very tiny. So you could easily miss them, quite frankly.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, I might have been looking for something way too big. You know, when you peel these back and you see these cockroaches, you think, well, I wonder if, you know, the emerald ash borer, the holes that I see in the wood are about the size of the cockroaches. So,
that's not way too big.
Emerald ash borer would be about an eighth of an inch across the holes. They're very small and D-shaped.
These are a quarter inch holes.
Do you have a city forester?
Boy, I don't know.
Belleville, I'm trying to remember.
I'm on the city forester.
Yeah.
That's another person I would contact is your city forester or a municipality near you that has a city forester to come out and look at it. This needs to be addressed.
I have two other very simple questions, and they're not related to that, if Larry has time.
Okay.
First one is on apple trees. I've heard before, you know, as a fertilizer to put potash what is potash? Is it, I mean, if I spread ashes from wood burning, you know, my wood burning stove, is that just totally not the same thing?
And no.
Not, okay.
It has some potassium in it, but go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, no, no, that's all right. I was just going to say the hotline number is 1-800-462-2003 for the Emerald Ash Borer hotline number.
I assume 2003 is when they first found it or something, huh?
1-800-462-2003.
Yep, okay. And then my last question is, I had planted a bunch of spruce trees. I think that they're called the green spruce. And you guys are thinking I'm just heck on trees. You know, I seem to destroy them all. But I planted a bunch, and I started a fire, and I burned off a couple little areas, and everything went exactly as planned, and I'm all proud of myself. And then, of course, I got a little more bold, and I started another fire to burn off some grass, and that one got away on me and burned probably 25 of my favorite trees that I look at.
Oh.
And that was rather hard. And so I'm wondering, you know, a lot of the trees, like, will be half green yet. Some have turned from half green. Now, this happened about 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago. And some of the trees went from partially green, you know, maybe at the top and all brown at the bottom to all brown. And mm-hmm. some of the trees have gone from, you know, they've stayed green in certain sections, and I'm assuming that section is alive. It being early in the season, will any of these trees be likely to survive? Even, you know, if they lose their needles, will they survive?
If they've lost their needles, no. They're done.
Yeah, and the brown ones.
For evergreens.
Yeah, if the needles are brown, they're toast,
they're
unfortunately.
Toast.
And I made a mistake on the hotline number by poor eyesight here. The number is 1-800-462-2803. It's not 2003. It's 2803. That's the number on that one. And sorry about the other. All your problems with trees, Alex. My goodness. Appreciate your call, though, and thanks very much for calling. On to Sandy in Crystal Lake. Sandy, hi.
Yes, good morning. I have a question about a Korean spice plant that we have. Mm-hmm. It's gotten a little bit large and unruly for the site where we have it. And I'm wondering if you can give me some advice on trimming it or pruning it, or is it like the rhododendrons where it grows from the ends and you can't trim it too much?
Well, the Korean spice, it's Korean spice viburnum, is one of my very favorite landscape plants. The
beautiful
flowers
plant.
Are extremely fragrant, and they flower about the first week of May, and they're white, look like little miniature snowballs. They're beautiful. If you prune them now, you're cutting off your flower buds. And that's not what you want to do, because that's mm-hmm. why you grow the plant. After it's done flowering, you can selectively trim back, going back to a lateral branch or a lateral bud. You don't want to prune Korean spice viburnum back very much at all. It's a slow-growing plant, and if you prune it back too much, it's going to take a long time to get it back to where you want it to be. But I would wait after right after flowering, then kind of bring back side shoots back to the main stem or to a lateral branch. But I wouldn't take a lot off on Korean spice because they are slow-growing.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks a lot for calling. And Lori in Sparta, we go to you now. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've heard of a product that is for sale at Hardware Hank that it's a systemic for ash tree, but it's before it gets infected that's supposed to keep it from getting infected.
No.
Have you heard of anything like that?
There are products available for treating for emerald ash borer. The current recommendation, though, from our insect specialist, who's Chris Williamson, is that unless you're within a 10 to 12 mile radius of an area where the emerald ash borer has been already identified as being present, that it's probably not necessary at this point to treat. So you may want to hold off, but there certainly are products that are out there,
and they're effective.
Yes, actually, the two active ingredients are imidacloprid and acephate are the two active ingredients that you would look for. There's a bear product that has the imidacloprid, and then there's a bonide product which I believe has the acephate. There are actually two other products, but I don't remember the brand names on those. But again, we do have a fact sheet. on these particular products? Are you hooked up to the internet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go to our website, WIHORT.
I wrote it down.
Okay, you've got it. Let me just say it again for the rest of the folks in the audience. WIHORT.UWEX.EDU. Click on the Garden Facts link, and then in the insect column, look for homeowner products for treating for emerald ash borer. And just click on that, and that'll open up the document, and you can read. And there's a list of the products and also exactly when they need to be applied and how they are applied. A couple of them are drench products. A couple of them are kind of encapsulated, and you actually have to inject them into the tree. I don't necessarily recommend those for homeowners. I would go with the drench products, I think. Those are going to be easier for you to apply. And it's less invasive for the tree if you're using the drench product.
Why do you recommend waiting until, now we're like 20 miles from
from a site?
Yeah,
a
site.
That's just the recommendation. It's based on research out of the university, or out of Michigan State University, where they've been working with this insect for a lot longer than we have. And based on the research, that's their recommendation.
It's partly a.
Is it going to lose effectiveness if you do it? And
it has to be done. You have to do it more than once. That is the issue.
Oh, right.
You have to do it every year. And it's expensive.
Yeah, it's not necessarily every year, but there is a cost involved to it. It isn't a one-time treatment, and it's just an issue of, you know, do you really want to go to the expense of treating a tree where you really don't have a problem, so or you're not within, you know, a distance where you would expect there to be a high likelihood of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But you can look at the, I mean, it's partly it, you know, it's a question of whether
up to you.
It is up to you, but that's the formal recommendation is to wait until you've got a sighting within 10 to 12 miles.
There you have it, Laurie. Thank you very much for calling. Laura Zhao and Brian Huddleston, our guests today as we talk woody ornamentals and plant diseases here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here with Laura Zhao from the UW-Madison, UW Extension Department of Horticulture. She's a woody ornamental specialist. And Brian Huddleston, plant disease diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at UW-Madison and UW-Extension. So happy to have them with us. Give us a call with your question about as we look at woody ornamentals or we look at plant diseases of any kind of plant disease. We'll be happy to try. 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. And, you know, before we go back to the phones, we've had some questions about pruning. And, Laura, you have a little publication or fact sheet, I believe.
Yeah, on the Wisconsin Horticulture website that we've given the address
many
10 times.
We'll
do it again. There's a fact sheet that three of them. One of them is how to properly prune evergreens. The other one is deciduous trees, how to properly prune them. And the other one is deciduous shrubs, how to properly prune them. So all three fact sheets are available for free on the Wisconsin Horticulture website. For you to download, either as a Word file or as a PDF file.
And your lilacs for cold climates
that's available.
Is also on there, too?
No, that one you have to purchase, or you could download as a PDF file off the Learning Store website.
So actually, what I usually do is put University of Wisconsin Extension Learning Store, because I can never remember. It's not that hard. It's
learningstore.uwex.edu.
not that hard to remember, but I can't remember it. So,
and you can just type lilac in the search engine, and it'll pop it up.
Pop it right up. All right. Steve in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi. We moved into a house about a year and a half ago, and it was real overgrown lot. We took out a lot of trees. We've got about a 40-foot, I believe it's a white pine, in the front yard. You know, branches perpendicular to the trunk and kind of a real feathery needles.
It's one of my favorite evergreens.
Okay. Well, it's the anchor to a corner of our front yard now, and I really would hate, but it's not looking real good. It's yellowish, the needles, there's some brown needles in the interior. It's just, a friend commented that it looked like it was a little sunburned. It's a little more green on the north side of it, but the south side that gets a full sun is really kind of yellowish.
Okay. Well, Laura, what do you think?
There's a couple things. First of all, it sounds like this is a well-established tree.
It's about a 40-foot tall one, yeah.
Yeah, it's been there a while. Okay. Second of all, one thing about white pines you should know is they do normally shed their inner needles. The needles only last 2 to 3 years on white pines, and then they shed the inner needles. So that shedding of inner needles on white pine is normal. How does the new growth look? Is the new growth that's coming, that's there on the plant right now, turning yellow?
No, it's yellow green.
Yeah.
Okay, it could be due to a number of issues. Chlorosis is one of the things that comes to mind. Have you raised the soil area around the tree at all?
No.
Okay, you've left that alone. You haven't raised the grade.
That's good.
That's very good. Yeah. That'll kill a tree.
It's down close to the street, and there's a natural indentation down by the street, and we get I'm thinking it's a real natural place for a rain garden.
Mm-hmm.
This is just up out of the, you know, kind of the ditch down by the street.
Right. White pine is also very sensitive to drainage. If that area floods, if it stays wet, white pine do not like that at all. That will also show yellowing of the foliage. The pH could be a problem as well, but if this tree has lived a long time in this location and it's just now turning yellow, it sounds more like either it's a drainage problem, or if there's salt injury, is it a busy road?
Not real busy.
Okay.
But
so it's not salt.
It's a residential street.
It's not salt.
I mean, we get salted.
Yeah. If it was a busy street, you had a lot of salt kicked up. Salt spray, and you will see symptoms of salt injury on one side of the plant alone, and it'll be the side facing the road. White pine is very sensitive to road salt injury, but it sounds like you might have some other problems.
Yeah, the other thing that comes to mind if you're in a wet area would be some root rot issues.
Yeah.
So the fungal infections in the root system that are inhibiting water and nutrient uptake, and that will oftentimes lead to yellowing of the needles and also some brown tips on some of the exterior needles as well.
Did you say it was 40 feet tall?
Yeah.
If it's 40 feet tall, that's got to be an old tree. How long do they live?
Oh, white pines can live hundreds of years.
That's not the issue. It's not it's getting too old because, okay, good.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
The trunk's about, you know, a diameter of 12 inches or something.
No, it's not huge. Has that area flooded last year?
Well, every spring.
Floods every spring.
It's flooded, and as our as things melt off in the wintertime and refreeze, there's a lot of water down by the street. That's why it's a real good natural place for us.
It sounds like a water issue. White pine is very sensitive to poor drainage. If it's flooded, that'll kill it. They need good drainage. It sounds like you might have some root rot starting from what Brian was saying.
Yeah, and there
too.
May be some physical death of the root tissue just from the flooding as well. Unfortunately, that's very difficult in a tree that old and that size to really do anything in terms of getting it to recover.
And there's not much you can do about the water issue unless you can figure out a way to let it drain away
drain away from it.
From the root area.
And don't pile new soil or sand or anything like that on top. That will exacerbate the problem.
Yeah. There you have it. I wish we had better news for you there, Steve, but think of some ways that you might get that water away from that white pine. Thanks a lot for calling. Nancy in Dubuque, Iowa. On to you now. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Listen, we had a red bud, which did very well for us for a number of years, and then about 3 years ago, it started to just kind of fail. The leaves got a little bit smaller, they weren't as thick, and then the branches started dying off.
Uh-huh.
And we finally decided that it had contracted verticillium wilt.
Uh-huh.
So last spring, we cut it down. And what I'm wondering about is, what would you recommend that we plant in its place?
Well, there's a lot of things very susceptible to verticillium wilt. Brian and I are just smiling at each other going, boy, I wish all these questions were this easy. Verticillium wilt is a horrible... In fact, I have a red bud in my yard that's now a dead bud due to verticillium wilt.
And I'm smiling very broadly here because this is probably one of our biggest money makers in the clinic is verticillium wilt, unfortunately. But yeah, it's very difficult to deal with, and many, many different types of plants are susceptible.
Yeah, all maples are susceptible to verticillium wilt. Ash is susceptible. Lilac is susceptible. Red bud, smoke bush, smoke tree, yellow wood, catalpa. Jeez,
all the trees that you would really like to grow in your yard tend to be susceptible. The one that I oftentimes recommend as a replacement, and Laura can comment on this,
service berry
or amelanchier. That's a beautiful little spring flowering tree, and it seems to be very, very resistant to verticillium.
And it's native, and it produces white flowers in spring and very yummy, tasty fruit in June.
How tall does this get?
Depending on the cultivar, anywhere from 15 to 25 feet, depending on the species and cultivar. I recommend the amelanchier grandiflora, and that's also known as apple serviceberry. Mm-hmm. That's one of the more disease-resistant ones, and there's a number of cultivars out there. If you're looking for a single stem, I would pick the cultivar Robin Hill. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for multi-stemmed, I like Princess Diana a lot, but there's a number of other ones that are very good, and it's got great fall color.
Okay. And good fruit, too. If you like to make muffins, if you can get to them before the birds, they make great muffins.
Too. And what about replacing it with an evergreen of some sort?
That would work as well.
Yeah, that'd work.
Evergreens in general are resistant to verticillium. The other one that I really like, I don't know if your site is appropriate, would be ginkgo. That's one of my all-time favorite trees. Uh-huh. And as far as we're aware, it's not susceptible to verticillium.
Just make sure you get a male cultivar.
Yeah, the females are a little messy.
Yeah, they produce very smelly fruit at about 20 years of age. So you get a named cultivar ginkgo like Autumn Gold, Princeton Century. There's a number of other ones out there. And those aren't male.
Terrific. Right. Thanks for your help.
Thanks a lot for calling. And let's move on to Ken in Algoma next. Hi, Kim.
Howdy. I have some hard maple on my tree lawn, which we planted in 1964. And a couple of years ago, I had the bark checked from the frost in the winter.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what I can do to save the tree, because each year this progresses a little further.
It sounds like I know exactly what your problem is. It's called frost crack.
Yep.
First of all, for our audience, a hard maple is any maple that produces their fruit in the late summer into fall. Sugar maple, Norway maple, for example, would be considered hard maples, whereas our native red maple, silver maple, and Freeman maple, those are all soft maples because they produce their fruit in spring. It has nothing to do with the wood. I don't know why they use that name, to my knowledge. Frost crack is often a symptom of another underlying problem that I see all the time on sugar maples and Norway maples, as well as red and silver, is they're planted too deep. You don't see any root flare at the soil line. And when they're planted too deep, you'll get decay of the roots, or some type of injury at the base of the tree can also cause this. And what will happen is you'll get an internal pocket of decay that starts to form inside of the tree. And then everybody thinks it's due to frost, but if you go out in the woods, you're not going to see frost crack. In the woods, the trees are planted at the right height and you don't see it. It happens when we plant our trees often with the ball and burlap in the basket, and we don't remove the wire basket. You should always remove the wire basket and plant it so that the root flare is at the soil line, and to avoid the situation. Now that you already have it, it's a little bit trickier. I am a big fan of air spade excavation. That is done by a professional arborist. That's not something you can run out and do yourself. And what they do is a very high pressure, it's like a probe, and there's air that comes out at the end of it. And it's high pressure, but it's not enough to kill the roots. And what it does is it knocks the heck out of the soil off of the root system around the base of the tree to expose that root flare. You may even have girdling roots that have formed, very common on Norway and sugar maples. And they can often remove that girdling root at the same time expose that root flare, which should be exposed at the soil line. That's where the trunk starts to flare out, where the roots meet. Frost crack, once you have it, you typically can't get rid of it, but you could help prevent it from occurring on your other trees, as well as try to alleviate some of the problems on your current tree.
So what would happen, though, if they were planted in 64 and they've been there that long?
And it's just now starting
just
to
now
do it?
Just now starting? Could be another problem.
It could be an injury at the base of the tree. Lawnmowers are classic injurers of trees. Weed whip also can damage at the base of the tree as well.
So it could have been that damage. And I'm sorry we don't have more time to talk with you, Ken. And I'm sorry we don't have more time to talk with Laura and Brian. Thank you guys both so much for being. You'll come back and do this again,
welcome.
I hope.
Of course.
Sure.
I look forward to it. Laura Jowell, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist for Woody Ornamentals with the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. Brian Huddleston, Plant Disease Diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at UW-Madison and UW-Extension. And we'll have them back and we'll do this again, of course, with them. Coming up, though, we're going to be talking about you're planting your garden. I know you probably have many of your plans made, but how about planting with an eye for preserving those fruits of your labor, especially drying? Mary Bell will be with us to talk about food drying next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.